Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The court is now in session. The judges are Judge Werke, Judge Jessen, Judge Gaitas, the Honorable Theodora Gaitas presiding.
Good morning to everyone, and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals and our September 13th calendar. We initially thought we would be seeing each other in person. Thank you for your flexibility. Our entire calendar, which consists of five oral arguments today, will be held via the Zoom platform. We are just going to dive right in with our first case. I see that both counsel are present. Our first case today is State of Minnesota Respondent versus Randall Jermaine Watkins Appellant. And just a few remarks to both of our attorneys before we get started. I know that you're both very familiar with our timing requirements, but I want to make sure that you can both see the clock on the screen, which will be keeping track of the time remaining in your arguments today. Can you both see the clock?
Yes.
All right. And just a couple other things. We are making an audio recording of the arguments this morning, which will be available shortly on our website. And to ensure that our audio recording is good quality, I just ask that when you are not speaking, you please use your mute button and only have that off when you are speaking. Are you both ready to go?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay, then we will begin our arguments with counsel for appellant. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, my name is Devi Axelson. I represent the appellant, Randall Watkins. Mr. Watkins is deserving of a new trial in this case because his trial attorney fell below the objective standard of reasonableness when he prepared Mr. Watkins to testify directly regarding his two defenses at trial, but then failed to ask him direct questions about those two defenses during his testimony. Mr. Watkins was prejudiced by that failure, and he's deserving of a new trial. Additionally, if time permits, we're asking that Mr. Watkins is deserving of a new trial based on the mistake by the district court in applying the wrong self-defense instruction regarding count one. The representation by Julius Nolan in this case fell below the objective standard of reasonableness because he prepared Mr. Watkins prior to trial to testify directly about his lack of intent in this case.
I have a preliminary question, and I think I know the answer, and it's probably better addressed to Mr. Marker, but you know, Mr. Nolan did say that it was not strategy, but that he forgot. So as a reviewing court, are we able to proceed with that and acknowledge that it was not strategy and just accept that it was not strategy? What's your position on that? And then, of course, Mr. Marker, we need to hear from him on that too.
My position is that it was not strategy, that he realized this mistake pretty quickly. He brought it to
the court. I guess what I'm getting at is can we take his statement, the attorney's statement, that it was not strategy, or should we look beyond that for determination as to whether we could conclude that it was not strategy?
I think here the district court would have had to grant an evidentiary hearing if the district court thought it was potentially strategy in this case, but the district court took the affidavit at their face value for both the defendant and from Mr. Nolan and assumed that everything they said in their statements was true. And so I think at this point that the district court or this court is bound by the district court's finding in that respect.
And Mr. Axelson, just to be clear, you're not challenging the district court's denial of an evidentiary hearing in this case.
I'm not, because the affidavits speak for themselves according to the district court's order, and the affidavits are favorable for the argument that I'm presenting today. Regarding the deficient representation here, though, both the district court and the state in this matter rely on a case, Bailey, that predates Strickland v. Washington, and I don't think is good law anymore. I think the decision for this court in this case is pretty easy on the deficient representation prong, and that's that no defense attorney would think it's objectively reasonable to prepare their client to testify regarding the mental state, which is required for both of those defenses that he presented in this case, and then forget to ask questions about direct questions about those statements, and that meets the deficient representation prong of the Strickland test. Unless the court has additional questions about that, I would move on to
I do have a question, because, you know, the way the judge considered it here, she said that it's not actually in the record, but that you could infer it as far as the instruction, and that the testimony isn't consolidated into one statement, but that's no different than a defendant that may not answer the way you prepped him. My question to you, Mr. Axelson, is the jury heard all of his presentation as far as he not intending. He says he was blind or sight impaired. He wasn't able to run. He could hear the swishing of the knife. Isn't that enough to convey? I guess you're going to say no, but we should consider that, of course, and compare that and contrast that to the other testimony they heard, that he didn't have any injuries and her DNA was not on the knife and so on. Why would we, as an appellate review court, review the various testimony in making that determination?
Well, I guess I have two answers for you. First, I'll address the self-defense, because that's most of the comments you made address the self-defense claim. And I think a similar example that I thought of in preparing for this case is that a prosecutor would not end their summation and a closing argument and not ask the jury to find the defendant guilty. In the same way that, even though there's bits and pieces over 120 pages of transcript testimony that spanned over a day and a half of trial, or at least over 2 days of trial, the fact that some evidence came out regarding his self-defense, the fact that there was no direct question that was made regarding the self-defense is a problem, because, again, the jury needs to be guided in the manner towards the defense that's made here. And without asking that direct question, or at least having that be the summation at the end of the testimony, then that's deficient representation. I think the bigger problem is regarding the intent element here. The intent element here, there is no testimony at all. There is nothing in the record regarding his lack of intent. And I think you have the problem of the jury goes back into the jury room and they're discussing the defense that's put forward on lack of intent. And the jury would say, well, he had the opportunity. He testified. He testified, again, over a couple of days of testimony and over 120 pages of transcript. I'm not sure how many hours that is, but it's a long time. And not once did he tell us that he didn't lack the intent when he shot the gun at Miss Gant. And so I think the prejudice certainly is worse regarding the lack of intent and on the top count than it is regarding the self-defense.
So, Mr. Axelson, the part of the testimony on of your client that I think came closest to addressing the prejudice was this one. And so give me your reaction to this. Was the question, why did you shoot her? And then the answer, I was in fear for my life. I didn't feel like I deserved to die in my house. And she just wouldn't stop. She wouldn't stop at stabbing at me. When I think about, was there prejudice from, and I'm assuming here it was error not to ask him the explicit question, why isn't that one enough? That seems to me to come pretty close.
Well, I would agree with you that comes close on self-defense. I think that is about as close as you get to self-defense. And, again, the stronger argument regarding the deficient representation is regarding intent. There is nothing similar to that regarding the lack of intent in this case. And again, the top count, the count that he gets sentenced on, the count that he gets 480 months in prison for, is the top count that requires intent. And there is nothing similar like that in the record regarding intent. So even if this court rules that there was enough in the record where prejudice isn't established regarding self-defense, there isn't something similar like that for the lack of intent. And it's clear that his lack of intent and his explanation for, where he shot her and and his behavior after, and the fact that, this was kind of ratcheting up all day long, but it's not just him. It's not a typical intentional murder case. because of the, you know, the situation that's going back and forth during the day and the both physical and abusive behavior by Ms. Gant that Mr. Watkins doesn't respond to for most of the day, but that lack of intent and the problem with a jury sitting in the jury room and discussing with themselves, is there a lack of intent here? And knowing full well that Mr. Watkins got up on the stand and never addressed that. And the reason he didn't address that was because of the deficient representation by his attorney. Just quickly on the second issue that's presented in this case, I wanted to point out that Mr. Marker is not the person who presented this brief, but in the brief that was presented by the Hennepin County Attorney's Office, counsel indicated that Mr. Noland had essentially invited error and had agreed to the more serious self-defense instruction, and that's just not true. If you look on page 966 of the transcript, when Mr. Noland's asked about the self-defense instruction that's applied on count one, he says, "My preference, of course, would be to have an instruction that said that he only feared an offense against the person." So there is Mr. Noland on the record, essentially objecting to the more serious self-defense instruction that's given. He makes a reference to Pollard.
But Mr. Axelson, I do wonder whether that's sufficient to constitute an objection, because he went on to say, absent the court doing that, this instruction, I think, is appropriate. And I don't see anywhere a direct objection to the instruction that was ultimately given as to count one. I guess this sounds like a really fundamental question, but what is an objection? What is sufficient to preserve the issue? And is saying, I think this instruction is appropriate, if you're not going to give what I'm asking for, an objection?
Well, I would say that that's a great question. I think that the answer here is that the first part is the objection. The second part essentially is equivalent to when evidence comes in that's not supposed to come in, and then the defense says, well, I'll agree that the judge should give a curative instruction. I think what Mr. Noland is saying there in the second part is that although I don't agree this is the correct instruction, the instruction as it's written is the appropriate instruction if you're going to give the more serious self-defense instruction. That's my takeaway from reading it. I think, and I haven't found it yet, hopefully I'll have it by rebuttal, but I think he does make a slightly more fervent argument against this at the very beginning of the case. But he does, again, this doesn't always happen in these cases, but he does cite the controlling law, which is Pollard. And Pollard is very definitive that that's not the correct instruction.
Well, so given how definitive Pollard is, do you have an argument, say we disagree with you that this wasn't sufficiently preserved by the trial attorney? Do you have an argument that this was plain error?
Yes, I think that Pollard, I don't remember off the top of my head, but I believe Pollard is a plain error case. I think there's actually multiple cases from both this court and the Supreme Court saying that, and at least in the unpublished case I know that's cited in my brief, that they find it's plain error in that case, that the failure to give the correct self-defense instruction when a defendant has specifically argued that he lacks intent in the case is plain error. And so we've met the plain error standard here based on Pollard and the other cases. And then ultimately this court has to look at the harmless error component. And again, I've cited it, and we're acknowledging that Carradine essentially says that if you're convicted of an intentional crime, that this is not prejudicial. But I think this case is different from those other cases. This case is different than Fry, which is provided by Mr. Marker in his supplemental authorities, because none of those cases involve a defense counsel who objectively fails to ask his client about his lack of intent. So in Carradine, the court is able to say that it's harmless error, because in Carradine, the defendant says, I didn't do this, or I didn't intend this. And at that point, the jury has rejected it. Here, we don't have the question asked, and Mr. Watkins the opportunity to say that he didn't intend this crime. And so this case is different than those other cases, and the failure to give the correct self-defense instruction on that top count is also prejudicial error and is deserving of a new trial. Unless the court has additional questions for me at this point, I yield the remaining minute of my time. Thank you.
I'm not seeing any additional questions. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Thank you for your argument. And next, we will turn to Mr. Marker.
Good morning. May it please the court. Counsel, I am Assistant Hennepin County Attorney Peter Marker for the state. I'd like to spend just a little bit of time on the Strickland issue and then a bit more time on the second issue, because I think as it's presented currently, I think it does lack some clarity for the court, and I'd like to make an attempt to clear that up a bit.
You agree it's not strategy. I mean, he said it wasn't strategy. We're bound by that, so we can't fish into, oh, it was trial strategy.
I do agree with Mr. Axelson on that, Your Honor. I do. I want to talk about the question of this failure to question the defendant about intent. I think it doesn't meet the performance prong. It's one missing question. There's the presentation of substantial evidence, at least through the defendant's version of the events, that is suggestive of a lack of intent. And as this court knows, the best evidence regarding intent is always going to be circumstantial evidence. The defendant's statement regarding his or her intent at trial is inevitably going to be seen as self-serving. I think it does not meet the performance prong here to miss that one question. Now, had defense counsel failed to present any evidence with regard to intent, that may be a different question, but it is, I believe, a question of pervasiveness rather than one missing question. The defendant testified to his affection for the victim and his daughter, the chaotic scene, the fact that he called an ambulance, the fact that he attempted CPR on the defendant. All of that evidence, if the jury believed it, goes to his stated lack of intent, or at least that was his position at trial. So the failure to ask the question was not only a lack of, constitutionally ineffective performance, for those same reasons, I think it doesn't meet the second prong either, because he did solicit, or he did elicit that testimony as to intent, which again is just much stronger than any stated intent that he's going to give the jury at trial. So I would ask the court to find that the defendant doesn't meet either Strickland prong on his ineffective assistance of counsel claim. As to the second issue, which I want to spend a little more time on, and with great respect to the author of the state's brief, and with some apology to this court, I'm going to depart from the state's brief a little bit here today. I think that the record shows that the defendant's claim at trial was that he did not intend to kill the victim. Now, I think the record also shows that he intended to shoot the gun, and I think it also shows that he intended to shoot the gun at the victim. But notwithstanding that, his claim at trial was that he didn't intend to kill the victim. And I think we take that claim on its face because that's his defense theory. And I don't think at this point that we question how far-fetched we may or may not believe that claim is.
So just so that I'm clear, you're arguing that regardless of Pollard, Carradine, it doesn't matter. This was not an error in the first instance because the instruction provided appropriately matched the defense.
Yeah, no, that's. I think the instruction did not match the defense with regard to count one. So with his defense stating that he did not intend, assuming there was evidence to support it, then he was entitled to the general self-defense instruction, not the taking of life instruction, which would have been appropriate if he said that he intended to kill, but he had to under the circumstances. And so the court and the parties here took the very unusual step of providing different instructions for each count. And so what they did was they provided the justifiable taking of life instruction as to the first count, because there is an intent element there, and the general defense instruction as to the second count, that's an unintentional count. I think that is error. The defendant, I think the case law is quite clear that the instruction that the defendant gets is based upon the defendant's theory of the case, not upon the elements of the offense that's charged. And so,
given your concession that it was error, I just want to point out one concern that I have that maybe you can address in moving on to discuss prejudice here. And I'm assuming that you're still going to be arguing that this is plain error because it wasn't objected to appropriately. Maybe we can come back to that. But my concern on the prejudice, regardless of the standard of review, I guess, is that if you look at the jury instructions that were provided to the jury, you know, the written instructions that are in the record, there's actually a note under the justifiable taking of life instruction that was given as to count one that says, the self-defense instruction is different for the two counts. Actually, that's as to count two. It says the self-defense instruction is different for the two counts, and this is not a mistake. And my concern there is, doesn't that make it harder for us to say, well, you know, the jury got, they got the appropriate instruction. They could have certainly applied that to both counts. So how does that affect the prejudice analysis?
Well, I think I understand your question, Your Honor. It's not because of the way you asked the question. It's difficult to wrap your head around these issues sometimes. There's no prejudice here for two important reasons. And one follows the Carradine line of cases. Because the jury found the defendant intended to kill the victim in this case, Carradine and cases that have followed Carradine have said that any failure to give the proper general self-defense instruction under those circumstances is harmless. And I think that's the case here. Now, Pollard is a little bit of an outlier, because Pollard, by the way, was not a plain error case. Pollard was a case where defense counsel requested the general self-defense instruction and didn't get it, which is not what happened here. And it's not what happened in Carradine. But Pollard is factually distinguishable. The court was not convinced in Pollard that the error was necessarily non-prejudicial. Because in Pollard, the victim testified, and that was a knife case. In Pollard, the victim testified that she never conceded that she intended to stab the victim. And that's not the case here. Here we have the defendant, at least by implication, conceding that he intended to shoot. He's just taking the position that he did not intend to kill. And that's why I provided the court with Frye, which is non-precedential. I certainly understand and acknowledge that, but it's just from 2 years ago. And that is a case where unusual facts, just like we have here, where the court gave two separate instructions, one as to the intentional count and one as to the unintentional count. And another panel of this court found that the instruction as to the intentional count was erroneous because the defendant's claim at trial was that he did not intend to kill. but that it was clearly harmless because the defendant was given the general instruction as to count two. And having rejected that self-defense claim with the general instruction, this court found that it would have been clearly harmless as to the erroneous instruction given as to count one. And I think that's exactly applicable here, because that's what happened.
So, he was Mr. Marker, if I may.
Yes, Your Honor.
I believe what Mr. Axelson was saying, and he'll correct me, I'm sure if I'm wrong on rebuttal, is, yeah, but Frye's different because, and this is assuming, okay, so let me ask you, let's assume that this panel thought it was error for trial counsel in it not to ask the explicit question about intent. But let's, okay, we found that's error, you know, and perhaps we'll find, yeah, but he still hasn't met the burden of showing prejudice under the Strickland second prong, but we found error. Shouldn't we, in evaluating whether there's, the prejudice issue under what you've admitted is error in the jury instruction, shouldn't we be looking cumulatively at that first error as well? And I apologize if that was too complicated a question. I'm happy to try and rephrase it.
Well, no, Your Honor, I think I understand. And the two issues do sort of cross paths, certainly, to a certain degree. I mean, look, I think the question, I don't think there's question that his claim at trial, and I don't think it was a strong claim, but his claim at trial was that he did not intend to kill the victim. That was his, I think that was established by counsel at trial. He forgot to ask the question, fair enough. But I think that was established through the evidence he presented at trial. And so since that was his claim, that he didn't intend to kill the victim, he was entitled to the general self-defense instruction on both counts. Now, he didn't get it on the top count. He should have, but he didn't get it on the top count. The jury rejected it as to the lower count. And so so the reason I provided Frye is because that's exactly what happened to Frye. The jury rejected the general self-defense claim as to the second unintentional count, which this court said makes it, he cannot establish harm from the initial, from the erroneous instruction on the top count because they applied the general instruction already in the case and rejected it. And I think that's true here as well. The jury found that he intended by its verdict on count one, that he intended to kill the victim here. So if you apply Carradine in that line of cases, that's harmlessness in and of itself. But if you want to look at harmlessness even further, then you look at the fact that not only did he get that, he got the general self-defense instruction as to the second count, and the jury rejected it, which further establishes that the error as to the top count was harmless. And I think that's true here as well.
One question that I kind of deferred at the beginning of your argument. Do you think the objection or what Mr. Axelson is characterizing as an objection was sufficient to preserve the error here? I know, you know, the brief argues that we should be in plain error world. But I know that you're also departing a little bit from the brief. What's your view about whether that error was preserved?
Your Honor, I think the error was not preserved. I agree. I stand by the brief on that point. If I read the transcript, Mr. Nolan is not lodging an objection that I can see. He is agreeing with the trial court's evaluation of the self-defense instruction applicable to count one. He's saying he's musing that, boy, it'd be nice to get that that general self-defense instruction as to count one. But I just don't see that as an objection. I see it as a conversation. It doesn't look preserved to me at all. And so, it's an important distinction, as the court knows, because with plain error, the standard for harmlessness is substantially lower than it would be had it preserved. And But even if this court had found that he preserved it, which I don't think is supported by the record, I think the same harmlessness analysis applies because he was convicted on the intentional count. And importantly, and this is Fry again, I'll direct your attention back to Fry, and the jury considered the general self-defense instruction in the case, which it did not have the opportunity to do in Pollard or those other cases. And I'm out of time. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Marker. We'll go back to Mr. Axelson. You have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Just quickly, regarding Mr. Marker's comment about the best evidence regarding intent is circumstantial evidence. I think that is often used in sufficiency of the evidence cases to discuss situations where the defendant hasn't testified. And here, yes, there is evidence that we pointed out in our brief regarding there is some lack of intent, circumstantial evidence, but we could have had direct evidence had defense counsel not been deficient in this case. We could have had direct evidence regarding probably his strongest argument in this case, and that's that he lacked intent on the top count, the count that he got sentenced on. And so the failure to ask the question regarding that, even though it's one question, it's the most important question. And it goes directly to his defense and his mental state of mind. We have a jury who's going to deliberate on that issue and not have his testimony and actually discuss the fact that they don't have his testimony on that. And that's why it's both deficient and prejudicial. Regarding the second issue, just quickly, Davis, which is in my brief, I think applies the plain error standard regarding the failure to give the right self-defense instruction. And so even if there isn't a proper objection lodge, which I believe there is, the pretty much the same analysis is going to apply. It's going to meet the first two prongs of plain error. And then I think both this court and the Supreme Court have said that the harmless error substantial rights prong of plain error is very similarly applied. And, you know, we meet that standard in this case, again, dating, you know, looking back to the problem in the first issue. And that's he's never asked about his lack of intent. And so, you know, this case is different than Fry. It's different than Carradine, and that we have deficient representation that caused the jury not to hear direct evidence about his lack of intent, which was supported by the record. Unless this court has additional questions, I would ask that on either point or on both points that Mr. Watkins is deserving of a new trial in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you both very much for your helpful argument.